Chapter 20. The Bitter Root. But now, you are twain. You are cloven apart. Flesh of his flesh, but heart of my heart. And deep in one is the bitter root. And sweet for one is the lifelong flower. Algernon Charles Swinburne. The Triumph of Time.
Tessa was just drawing on her velvet gloves as she ducked through the front doors of the Institute. A sharp wind had come up off the river and was blowing armfuls of leaves through the courtyard. The sky had gone thunderous and gray. Will stood at the foot of the stairs, hands in his pockets, looking up at the church steeple. He was hatless, and the wind lifted his black hair and blew it back from his face. He did not seem to see Tessa, and for a moment she stood and looked at him. She knew it was not right to do. Jem was hers, she was his now, and other men might as well not exist. But she could not stop herself from comparing the two. Jem with his odd combination of delicacy and strength. And Will, like a storm at sea, slate blue and black with brilliant flashes of temper like heat lightning. She wondered if there would ever be a time when the sight of him didn't move her, make her heart flutter. And if that feeling would subside as she grew used to the idea of being engaged to Jem. It was new enough still that it did not seem real. There was one thing that was different, though. When she looked at Will now, she no longer felt any pain. Will saw her then, and smiled through the hair that blew across his face. He reached up to push it back. "That's a new dress, isn't it?" he said as she came down the stairs. "Not one of Jessamine's." She nodded and waited for him to say something sarcastic about her, Jessamine, the dress, or all three. "It suits you? Odd that gray would make your eyes look blue, but it does." She looked at him in astonishment, but before she could do more than open her mouth to ask him if he was feeling all right, the carriage came rattling around the corner of the Institute with Cyril at the reins. He pulled up in front of the steps, and the door of the carriage opened. Charlotte was inside, wearing a wine-colored velvet dress and a hat with a sprig of dried flowers on it. She looked as nervous as Tessa had ever seen her.
"Get in quickly,"
she called, holding her hat on as she leaned out the door.
"I think it's going to rain."
To Tessa's surprise, Cyril drove her, Charlotte, and Will not to the manor house in Chiswick, but to an elegant house in Pimlico, which was apparently the Lightwoods' weekday residence. It had begun to rain, and their wet things, gloves, hats, and coats, were taken from them by a sour-faced footman before they were ushered down many polished corridors and into a large library, where a roaring fire burned in a deep grate. Behind a massive oak desk sat Benedict Lightwood, his sharp profile made even sharper by the play of light and shadow inside the room. The drapes were pulled across the windows, and the walls were lined with heavy tomes, bound in dark leather, gold printing across the spines. On either side of him stood his sons, Gideon at his right, his blonde hair falling forward to hide his expression, his arms crossed over his broad chest. On the other side was Gabriel, his green eyes alight with a superior amusement, his hands in the pockets of his trousers. He looked as if he were about to start whistling. "Charlotte," said Benedict. "Will, Miss Gray, always a pleasure." He gestured for them to seat themselves in the chairs set before the desk. Gabriel grinned nastily at Will as he sat. Will looked at him, his face a careful blank, and then looked away. Without sarcastic remark, Tessa thought, baffled. Without even a cold glare. What was going on? "Thank you, Benedict." Charlotte, tiny, her spine straight, spoke with perfect poise. "For seeing us on such short notice."
"Of course," he smiled. "You do know that there's nothing you can do that's going to change the outcome of this. It isn't up to me what the council rules. It is their decision entirely."
Charlotte tilted her head to the side. "Indeed, Benedict, but it is you who are making this happen. If you had not forced Consul Wayland into making a show of disciplining me, There would be no ruling. Benedict shrugged his narrow shoulders.
Ah, Charlotte, I remember you when you were Charlotte Fairchild. You were such a delightful little girl, and believe it or not as you will, I am fond of you even now. What I am doing is in the best interests of the Institute and the Clave. A woman cannot run the Institute. It is not in her nature. You'll be thanking me when you're home with Henry raising the next generation of shadow hunters, as you should be. It might sting your pride, but in your heart, you know I'm correct. Charlotte's chest rose and fell rapidly.
If you abdicated your claim on the Institute before the ruling, do you truly think it would be such a disaster? Me, running the Institute?
Well, we'll never find out, will we?
Oh, I don't know, Charlotte said. I think most council members would choose a woman over a dissolute reprobate who fraternizes not just with downworlders, but with demons.
There was a short silence. Benedict didn't move a muscle, nor did Gideon. Finally, Benedict spoke, though now there were teeth in the smooth velvet of his voice.
Rumors and innuendo.
Truth and observation, said Charlotte. Will and Tessa were at your last gathering, and Chiswick, they observed a great deal.
That demon woman you were lounging with on the divan, said Will. Would you call her a friend or more of a business associate?
Benedict's dark eyes hardened. Insolent puppy.
Oh, I'd say she was a friend, said Tessa.
One doesn't usually let one's business associates lick one's face.
Although I could be wrong. What do I know about these things? I'm only a silly woman.
Will's mouth quirked up at the corner.
Gabriel was still staring.
Gideon had his eyes on the floor. Charlotte sat perfectly composed, hands in her lap.
All three of you are quite foolish, said Benedict,
gesturing contemptuously toward them. Tessa caught a glimpse of something on his wrist, a shadow, like the coils of a woman's bracelet, before his sleeve fell back to cover it.
That is, if you think the council will believe any of your lies?
You, he cast a dismissive look at Tessa,
are a downworlder. Your word is worthless.
And you, he flung an arm at Will, are a certifiable lunatic who fraternizes with warlocks. Not just this chit here, but Magnus Bane as well.
And when they test me under the mortal sword and I refute your claims, who do you think will be believed, you or me?
Will exchanged a quick look with Charlotte and Tessa. He had been right, Tessa thought. The Benedict did not fear the sword.
There is other evidence, Benedict, he said.
Oh?
Lightwood's lip curled upward in a sneer.
And what is that?
The evidence of your own poisoned blood, said Charlotte. Just now, when you gestured at us, I saw your wrist. How far has the corruption spread? It begins on the torso, does it not, and spreads down the arms and legs.
What is he talking about?
Gabriel's voice was a mixture of fury and terror.
Father!
Demon pox, said Will,
with the satisfaction of the truly vindicated.
What a disgusting accusation, began Benedict.
Refute it then, said Charlotte. Pull up your sleeve, show us your arm. The muscle by the side of Benedict's mouth twitched again. Tessa watched him in fascination. He did not terrify her, as Mortmain had, but rather disgusted her, the way the sight of a fat worm wriggling across a garden might. She watched as he whirled on his eldest son.
You,
he snarled,
you told them! You betrayed me!
I did, said Gideon, raising his head and uncurling his arms at last. And I would again.
Gideon, it was Gabriel, sounding bewildered.
Father, what are you talking about?
Your brother has betrayed us, Gabriel. He has told our secrets to the Branwells. Benedict spat his words out like poison. Gideon, Arthur, Lightwood. Benedict went on. His face looked older, the lines at the sides of his mouth more severe. But his tone was unchanged. I suggest you think very carefully about what you have done and what you will do next.
I have been thinking, said Gideon in his soft, low voice. Ever since you called me back from Spain, I have been thinking. As a child, I assumed all shadow hunters lived as we did, condemning demons by the light of day, yet fraternizing with them under cover of darkness. I now realize that is not true. It is not our way, Father. It is your way. You have brought shame and filth upon the name Lightwood. There is no need to be melodramatic.
Melodramatic?
There was terrible contempt in Gideon's normally flat tone. Father, I fear for the future of the Enclave if you get your hands on the Institute.
I am telling you now, I will witness against you at the Council. I will hold the mortal sword in my hands and I will tell Consul Wayland
why I think Charlotte is 1,000 times more fit than you are to run the Institute.
I will reveal what goes on here at night to every member of the Council. I will tell them that you are working for Mortmain, and I will tell them why.
Gideon! It was Gabriel, his voice sharp, cutting across his brother's.
You know, our custodianship of the Institute was Mother's dying wish, and it was the fault of the Fairchilds that she died.
That is a lie, said Charlotte. She took her own life, but not because of anything my father did. She looked directly at Benedict. It was, rather, because of something your father did.
Gabriel's voice rose.
What do you mean? Why would you say such a thing? Father?
Quiet, Gabriel.
Benedict's voice had gone hard and commanding, but for the first time, there was fear in his voice and eyes.
Charlotte, what are you saying?
You know very well what I am saying, Benedict, said Charlotte.
The question is whether you wish me to share my knowledge with the Clave and with your children. You know what it will mean for them.
Benedict sat back. I know blackmail when I hear it, Charlotte. What do you want from me? It was Will who responded, too eager to hold himself back any longer.
Withdraw your claims on the Institute. Speak out for Charlotte in front of the Council. Tell them why you think the Institute should be left in her keeping. You are a well-spoken man. You'll think of something, I'm sure.
Benedict looked from Will to Charlotte. His lip curled.
Those are your terms?
Before Will could speak, Charlotte said.
Not all our terms. We need to know how you have been communicating with Mortmain and where he is.
Benedict chuckled.
I communicated with him through Nathaniel Gray. But since you've killed him, I doubt he will be a forthcoming source of information.
Charlotte looked appalled.
You mean no one else knew where he was?
I certainly don't, said Benedict. Mortmain is not that stupid, unfortunately for you. He wished me to be able to take the Institute
that he might strike at it from its heart. But it was only one of his many plans, a strand of his web.
He has been waiting for this a long time. He will have the Clave,
and he will have her.
His eyes rested on Tessa.
What does he intend to do with me? Tessa demanded.
I don't know, Benedict said with a sly smile. I do know he was consistently asking after your welfare.
Such concern.
So touching in a potential bridegroom.
He says he created me, said Tessa.
What does he mean by that?
I haven't the vaguest idea. You are mistaken if you think he make me his confidant.
Yes, said Will. You two don't seem to have much in common, save a penchant for demon women and evil.
Will,
snapped Tessa.
I didn't mean you, said Will, looking surprised. I meant the Pandemonium Club.
If you are quite done with your byplay, said Benedict, I wish to make one thing very clear to my son.
Gideon,
understand that if you support Charlotte Branwell in this, you will no longer be welcome under my roof. It is not for nothing that they say a man should never hang all his bells on one horse.
In answer, Gideon raised his hands in front of him, almost as if he meant to pray. But Shadow Hunters did not pray, and Tessa realized quickly what he was doing, slipping the silver ring from his finger, the ring that was like Jem Carstairs' ring. Only this one had a pattern of flames about the band. The Lightwood family ring.
He set it down on the edge of his father's desk and turned to his brother.
Gabriel, he said, will you come with me?
Gabriel's green eyes were brilliant with anger.
You know I cannot.
Yes, you can.
Gideon held his hand out to his brother. Benedict stared between the two of them. He had paled slightly, as if suddenly realizing that he might lose not just one son, but both.
His hand gripped the edge of the desk, his knuckles whitening.
Tessa could not help staring at the expanse of the wrist that was revealed as his sleeve rose. It was very pale, banded with black circular striations. Something about the sight nauseated her, and she rose from her seat. Will, beside her, was already standing. Only Charlotte was still sitting, as prim and expressionless as ever.
Gabriel, please, Gideon said, come with me.
Who will take care of Father? What will people say about our family if we both abandon him?
Gabriel said, bitterness and desperation coloring his tone.
Who will manage the estates, the council seat?
I don't know, said Gideon. But it does not need to be you. The law.
Gabriel's voice shook.
Family before law, Gideon.
His eyes locked with his brother's for a moment. Then he looked away, chewing his lip, and went to stand behind Benedict, his hand on the back of his father's chair.
Benedict smiled. In this one thing, at least, he was triumphant.
Charlotte rose to her feet, her chin held high.
I trust we will see you tomorrow, in the council chamber.
Benedict, I trust you will know what to do, she said, and swept from the room, Gideon and Tessa on her heels.
Only Will hesitated a moment, in the doorway, his eyes on Gabriel. But when the other boy did not look at him, he shrugged at last and went out after the others, shutting the door behind him.
They rode back to the Institute in silence, rain lashing against the windows of the carriage. Charlotte attempted several times to speak to Gideon, but he was silent, staring at the blurred view of the streets as they rolled by. Tessa could not tell if he was angry or regretted his actions, or might even be relieved. He was as impassive as always, even as Charlotte explained to him that there would always be a room for him at the Institute, and that they could hardly express their gratitude for what he had done. At last, as they rattled down the Strand, he said,
I had really thought Gabriel would come with me, once he knew about Mortmain.
He does not understand yet, said Charlotte. Give him time.
How did you know? Will looked at Gideon keenly.
We only just discovered what happened to your mother, and Sophie said you had no idea.
I had Cyril deliver two notes, said Charlotte. One for Benedict and one for Gideon.
He slipped it into my hand while my father was not looking, Gideon said. I had only just time to read it before you came in.
And you chose to believe it? Said Tessa. So quickly?
Gideon looked toward the rain-washed window. His jaw was set in a hard line.
Father's story about mother's death never made sense to me. This made sense.
Crowded into the damp carriage, with Gideon only a few feet from her, Tessa felt the oddest urge to reach out to him, to tell him that she too had had a brother whom she had loved and had lost to what was worse than death, that she understood. She could now see what Sophie liked in him, the vulnerability, under the impassive countenance, the solid honesty beneath the handsome bones of his face. She said nothing, however, sensing it would not be welcome. Will, meanwhile, sat beside her, a bundle of coiled energy. Every once in a while she would catch a flash of blue as he looked at her, or the edge of a smile, a surprisingly sweet smile, something like giddiness, which she had never associated with Will before. It was as if he were sharing a private joke with her, only she was not entirely sure she knew what the joke was. Still, she felt his tension so keenly that her own calm, or what there was of it, was entirely cut up by the time they finally reached the Institute, and Cyril, soaked to the skin, but friendly as always, came around the carriage to open the doors. He helped Charlotte out first, and then Tessa, and then Will was beside her, having jumped down from the carriage and narrowly skirted a puddle. It had stopped raining. Will glanced up at the sky and took hold of Tessa's arm.
Come along,
he whispered, steering her toward the front door of the Institute. Tessa glanced back over her shoulder to where Charlotte stood at the foot of the steps, having succeeded, it seemed, in finally getting Gideon to speak to her. She was gesturing animatedly, using her hands.
We ought to wait for them, oughtn't we? Tessa began.
Will shook his dark head determinedly. Charlotte will be blathering at him for ages about what room he wants to stay in, and how grateful she is for his help. And all I want is to talk to you. Tessa stared at him as they entered the Institute. Will wanted to talk to her. He had said so before, true, but to speak so straightforwardly was very unlike him. A thought seized her. Had Jem told him of their engagement? Was he angry, thinking her not worthy of his friend? But when would Jem have had a chance? Perhaps while she was dressing. But then, Will did not look angry. I can't wait to tell Jem about our meeting, he said as they mounted the stairs. He'll never believe that scene. For Gideon to turn on his father like that, it's one thing to tell secrets to Sophie, another to renounce your whole allegiance to your family. Yet he cast away his family ring.
It is as you said, Tessa said as they turned at the top of the stairs and made their way down the corridor.
Will's gloved hand was warm on her arm. Gideon's in love with Sophie. People will do anything for love. Will looked at her as if her words had jolted him, then smiled, that same maddeningly sweet smile he had given her in the carriage. Amazing, isn't it? Tessa made as if to answer, but they had reached the drawing room. It was bright inside. The witchlight torches were high, and there was a fire in the grate. The curtains were drawn back, showing squares of leaden sky. Tessa took off her hat and gloves and was just laying them on a small Moroccan table when she saw that Will, who had followed her in, was drawing closed the bolt on the door. Tessa blinked. Will, why are you locking? She never finished her sentence. Covering the space between them in two long strides, Will reached her and caught her up in an embrace. She gasped in surprise as he took her by the arms, walking her backward until they half collided with the wall, her crinolette protesting.
Will,
she said in surprise, but he was pinning her to the wall with his body, his hands sliding up her shoulders into her damp hair, his mouth sudden and hot on hers. She fell and spun and drowned in his kiss. His lips were soft and his body was hard against hers, and he tasted like rain. Heat spread through the pit of her stomach as his mouth moved urgently on hers, willing her response. Jem's face flashed against the back of her closed eyelids. She put her hands flat against Will's chest and shoved him away from her as hard as she could. Her breath came out on a violent exhalation.
No!
Will took a surprised step backward. His voice, when he spoke, was throaty and low.
But last night, in the infirmary, you embraced me.
I did? With an acute shock, she realized that what she had taken for a dream had been no dream at all. Or was he lying? But no. There was no manner in which he could have known what she had dreamed. Her words stumbled over themselves. I thought I was dreaming. The hazy look of desire was fast vanishing from his eyes, replaced by hurt and confusion. He almost stammered. But even today, I thought you said you were as eager to be alone with me as I was.
I imagine you wanted an apology. You saved my life at the tea warehouse, and I am grateful, Will. I thought you wanted me to tell you that...
Will looked as if she had slapped him.
I didn't save your life so you'd be grateful. Then what?
Her voice rose.
You did it because it's your mandate, because the law says... I did it because I love you.
He half shouted, and then, as if registering the shocked look on her face, he said in a more subdued voice,
I love you, Tessa. And I have loved you almost since the moment I met you.
Tessa laced her hands together. They were icy cold.
I thought you couldn't be crueler than you were on the roof that day. I was wrong. This is crueler.
Will stood motionless. Then he shook his head slowly, from side to side, like a patient denying the deadly diagnosis of a physician.
You don't believe me. Of course I don't believe you. After the things you said, the way you've treated me.
I had to, he said.
I had no choice, Tessa. Listen.
She began to move toward the door. He scrambled to block her way, his blue eyes burning. Please, listen, please. Tessa hesitated. The way he said please, the catch in his voice, this was not like it had been on the roof. Then he had barely been able to look at her. Now he was staring at her desperately, as if he could will her to remain with desire alone. The voice that cried within her that he would hurt her, that he was not sincere, grew softer, buried under an ever-loudening, treacherous voice that told her to stay, to hear him out. Tessa. Will pushed his hands through his black hair, his slim fingers trembling with agitation. Tessa remembered what it was like to touch that hair, to have her fingers wound through it like rough silk against her skin. What I am going to tell you, I have never told another living soul but Magnus, and that was only because I needed his help. I've not even told Jem. Will took a deep breath. When I was 12, living with my parents in Wales, I found a Pyxis in my father's office. She was not sure what she had expected Will to say, but this was not it. A Pyxis? But why would your father keep a Pyxis? A memento from his shadow hunting days. Who can guess? But do you recall the codex discussing curses and how they can be cast? Well, when I opened the box, I released a demon, Marbus, who cursed me. He swore that anyone who loved me was doomed to die. I might not have believed it. I was not well schooled in magic. But my older sister died that night, horribly. I thought it was the beginning of the curse. I fled my family, and I came here. It seemed to me the only way to keep them safe. Not to bring them death on death. I did not realize at first that I was walking into a second family. Henry, Charlotte, even bloody Jasmine. I had to make sure that no one here could ever love me. To do so, I thought, would be to put them into deadly danger. For years, I have held everyone at arm's length, everyone I could not push away entirely. Tessa stared at him. The words echoed in her head. Held everyone at arm's length. Pushed everyone away. She thought of his lies, his hiding, the unpleasantness to Charlotte and Henry, the cruelties that seemed forced, even the story of Tatiana, who had only loved him the way little girls did, and whose affections he had crushed. And then there was Jem, she whispered. He looked at her miserably. Jem is different, he whispered. Jem is dying. You let Jem in because he was already near death? You thought the curse wouldn't affect him? And with every year that passed and he survived, that seemed more likely. I thought I could learn to live like this. I thought when Jem was gone after I turned 18, I'd go live by myself, not inflict myself or my curse on anyone, and then everything changed. Because of you. Me? Said Tessa in a quiet, stunned voice. The ghost of a smile touched his mouth. When I first met you, I thought you were unlike anyone else I had ever known. You made me laugh. No one but Jem has made me laugh in, good God, 5 years. And you did it like it was nothing. Like breathing. You did not even know me. Well, ask Magnus. He'll tell you. After that night on the roof, I went to him. I had pushed you away because I thought you had begun to realize how I felt about you. In the sanctuary that day, when I thought you were dead, I realized you must have been able to read it on my face. I was terrified. I had to make you hate me, Tessa. So I tried. And then I wanted to die. I had thought I could bear it if you hated me, but I could not. I realized you would be staying in the Institute and that every time I saw you, it would be like standing on that roof all over again, making you despise me and feeling as if I were choking down poison. I went to Magnus and demanded that he help me find the demon who had cursed me in the first place, that the curse might be lifted. If it was, I thought I could try again. It might be slow and painful and nearly impossible, but I thought I could make you care for me again, if only I could tell you the truth. That I could gain your trust back, build something with you. Slowly. Are you saying
the curse is lifted? That it's gone? There is no curse on me, Tessa. The demon tricked me. There never was a curse. All these years, I've been a fool. But not so much a fool that I didn't know that the first thing I needed to do once I had learned the truth was tell you how I really felt. He took another step forward. And this time, she did not move back. She was staring at him, at the pale, almost translucent skin under his eyes, at the dark hair curling at his temples, the nape of his neck, at the blue of his eyes and the curve of his mouth. Staring at him the way she might stare at a beloved place she was not sure she would ever see again, trying to commit the details to memory, to paint them on the backs of her eyelids that she might see it when she shut her eyes to sleep. She heard her own voice, as if from very far away. "Why me?" she whispered. "Why me, Will?" He hesitated. "After we brought you back here, after Charlotte found your letters to your brother, I read them." Tessa heard herself say very calmly, "I know you did. I found them in your room when I was there with Jam." He looked startled. "You said nothing to me about it." "At first I was angry," she admitted. "But that was the night we found you in the Ifrit den. I felt for you, I suppose. I told myself you had only been curious or Charlotte had asked you to read them." "She didn't," he said. "I pulled them out of the fire myself. I read them all, every word you wrote, and you and I, Tess, we're alike. We live and breathe words. It was books that kept me from taking my own life after I thought I could never love anyone, never be loved by anyone again. It was books that made me feel that perhaps I was not completely alone. They could be honest with me, and I with them. Reading your words, what you wrote, how you were lonely sometimes and afraid, but always brave, the way you saw the world, its colors and its textures and sounds, I felt the way you thought, hoped, felt, dreamed. I felt I was dreaming and thinking and feeling with you. I dreamed what you dreamed. Wanted what you wanted, and then I realized that truly, I just wanted you. The girl behind the scrawled letters. I loved you from the moment I read them. I love you still." Tessa had begun to tremble. This was what she had always wanted someone to say. What she had always, in the darkest corner of her heart, wanted Will to say. Will, the boy who loved the same books she did. The same poetry she did, who made her laugh even when she was furious. And here he was standing in front of her, telling her he loved the words of her heart, the shape of her soul, telling her something she had never imagined anyone would ever tell her, telling her something she would never be told again, not in this way, and not by him. And it did not matter. "It's too late," she said. "Don't say that." His voice was half a whisper. "I love you, Tessa. I love you." She shook her head. "Will, stop." He took a ragged breath. "I knew you would be reluctant to trust me," he said. "Tessa, please. Is it that you do not believe me, or is it that you cannot imagine ever loving me back? Because if it's the second..." "Will, it doesn't matter. Nothing matters more." His voice grew in strength. "I know that if you hate me, it is because I forced you to. I know that you have no reason to give me a second chance to be regarded by you in a different light. But I am begging you for that chance. I will do anything, anything." His voice cracked, and she heard the echo of another voice inside it. She saw Jem looking down at her. All the love and light and hope and expectancy in the world caught up in his eyes. "No," she whispered. "It isn't possible." "It is," he said desperately. "It must be. You cannot hate me as much as all that." "I don't hate you at all," she said with great sadness. "I tried to hate you well, but I can never manage it." "Then there's a chance." Hope fled in his eyes. She should not have spoken so gently. Oh, God, was there nothing that would make this less awful? She had to tell him. Now, quickly, cleanly. Tessa, if you don't hate me, then there's a chance that you might... Jem has proposed to me, she blurted out. And I have said yes. What? I said that Jem proposed to me, she whispered. He asked if I would marry him, and I said I would. Will had gone shockingly white. He said, Jem. My Jem. She nodded, without words to say. Will staggered and put his hand on the back of a chair for balance. He looked like someone who had been suddenly viciously kicked in the stomach. When? This morning. But we have been growing closer, much closer for a long time. You and Jem. Will looked as if he were being asked to believe in something impossible. Snow in summertime, a London winter without rain. In answer, Tessa touched with her fingertips the jade pendant Jem had given her. He gave me this, she said. Her voice was very quiet. It was his mother's bridal gift. Will stared at it, at the Chinese characters on it, as if it were a serpent curled about her throat. He never told me anything. He never said a word about you to me. Not that way. He pushed his hair back from his face, that characteristic gesture she had seen him make 1,000 times. Only now his hand was visibly shaking. Do you love him? Yes, I love him, she said, as she saw Will flinch. Don't you? But he would understand, he said dazedly. If we explained it to him, if we told him, he would understand. For a moment, Tessa imagined herself drawing the pendant off, going down the hallway, knocking on Jem's door, giving it back to him, telling him she had made a mistake, that she could not marry him. She could tell him everything about herself and about Will, how she was not sure, how she needed time, how she could not promise him all of her heart, how some part of her belonged to Will and always would. And then she thought of the first words she had ever heard Jem speak. His eyes closed, his back to her, his face to the moonlight. Will? Will, is that you? The way Will's voice, his face, softened for Jem, as it did for no one else. The way Jem had gripped Will's hands in the infirmary while he bled. The way Will had called out, James! When the warehouse automaton had knocked Jem down. I cannot sever them, one from another, she thought. I cannot be responsible for such a thing. I cannot tell either of them the truth. She imagined Jem's face if she called off the engagement. He would be kind. Jem was always kind. But she would be breaking something precious inside him, something essential. He would not be the same afterward, and there would be no Will to comfort him. And he had so little time. And Will... what would he do then? Whatever he might think now, she knew that if she broke things off with Jem, even then, he would not touch her, would not be with her, no matter how much he loved her. How could he parade his love for her in front of Jem, knowing his happiness came at the cost of his best friend's pain? Even if Will told himself he could manage it, to him she would always be the girl Jem loved, until the day Jem died. Until the day she died. He would not betray Jem, even after death. If it had been anyone else in the world. But she did not love anyone else in the world. These were the boys she loved, for better and for worse. She made her voice as cold as she could, as calm. Told him what? Will only looked at her. There had been light in his eyes on the stairs as he'd locked the door. When he'd kissed her, a brilliant, joyous light. And it was going now, fading like the last breath of someone dying. She thought of Nate bleeding to death in her arms. She had been powerless then to help him, as she was now. She felt as if she were watching the life bleed out of Will Herondale, and there was nothing she could do to stop it. Jem would forgive me, Will said, but there was a hopelessness in his face, his voice, already. He had given up. Tessa thought.
Will, who never gave up on any fight before it had started.
He would, she said. He could never stay angry at you, Will. He loves you too well for that. I do not even think he would hold anger toward me. But this morning he told me he thought he would die without ever loving anyone as his father loved his mother, without ever being loved like that in return. Do you want me to go down that hallway and knock on his door and take that away from him? And would you love me still, if I did?
Will looks at her for a long moment. Then he seemed to crumple inside, like paper. He sat down in the armchair and put his face into his hands.
You promised me, he said, that you love him, enough to marry him and make him happy.
Yes, she said.
Then, if you love him, he said quietly, please, Tessa, don't tell him what I just told you. Don't tell him that I love you.
And the curse? He doesn't know?
Please don't tell him about that either. Nor Henry, nor Charlotte, no one. I must tell them in my own time, in my own way.
Pretend I said nothing to you, if you care about me at all, Tessa.
I will tell no one, she said. I swear it, I promise it, on my angel, my mother's angel. And, well,
he had lowered his hands, but he still could not seem to look at her. He was gripping the sides of the armchair, his knuckles white.
I think you had better go, Tessa.
But she could not bear to. Not when he was looking like that, like he was dying on the inside. More than anything else, she wanted to go and put her arms around him, to kiss his eyes closed, to make him smile again.
What you have endured, she said, since you were 12 years old, it would have killed most people. You have always believed that no one loved you, that no one could love you, as their continued survival was proof to you that they did not. But Charlotte loves you, and Henry, and Jem, and your family. They all have always loved you, Will Herondale, for you cannot hide what is good about yourself, however hard you try.
He lifted his head and looked at her. She saw the flame of the fire reflected in his blue eyes.
And you? Do you love me?
Her nails dug into her palms.
Will, she said.
He looked at her, almost through her, blindly.
Do you love me?
I... She took a deep breath. It hurt. Jem has been right about you all this time. You were better than I gave you credit for being, and for that I am sorry. Because if this is you, what you are truly like, and I think that it is, that you will have no difficulty finding someone to love you, Will. Someone for whom you come first in their heart. But I...
He made a sound halfway between a choking laugh and a gasp. First in your heart, he said. Would you believe that is not the only time you have said that to me?
She shook her head, bewildered.
Well, I have not. You can never love me, he said flatly.
And when she did not respond, when she said nothing, he shuddered. A shudder that ran through his whole body and pushed away from the armchair without looking at her. He stood up stiffly and crossed the room, groping for the bolt on the door. She watched with her hand across her mouth as, after what seemed like an age, he found it, fumbled it open, and went out into the corridor, slamming the door behind him.
Well, she thought.
Will, is that you? The backs of her eyes ached. Somehow she had found that she was sitting on the floor in front of the grate of the fire. She stared at the flames, waiting for tears to come. Nothing happened. After such a long time of forcing them back, it seemed she had lost the ability to cry. She took the poker from the fireplace iron holder and drove the tip of it into the heart of the burning coals, feeling the heat on her face. The jade pendant around her throat warmed, almost burning her skin. She drew the poker out of the fire. It glowed as red as a heart. She closed her hand around the tip. For a moment, she felt absolutely nothing. And then, as if from a great distance, she heard herself cry out,
and it was like a key turned inside her heart, freeing the tears at last. The poker clattered to the ground. When Sophie came dashing in, having heard her scream, she found Tessa on her knees by the fire, her burned hand pressed to her chest, sobbing as if her heart would break.
It was Sophie who took Tessa to her room, and Sophie who put her in her nightgown and then in bed, and Sophie who washed her burned hand with a cool flannel and bound it up with a salve that smelled like herbs and spices. The same salve, she told Tessa, that Charlotte had used on Sophie's cheek when she had first come to the Institute. Do you think I'll have a scar? Tessa asked, more out of curiosity than because she cared one way or the other. The burn and the weeping that had followed it seemed to have seared and flooded all the emotion out of her. She felt as light and hollow as a shell.
Probably a bit of a one, not like I've got, said Sophie frankly, securing the bandage around Tessa's hand. Burns hurt worse than they are, if you catch my meaning, and I got to you quickly with the salve. You'll be all right.
No, I won't be, said Tessa, looking at her hand, and then over at Sophie. Sophie, lovely as always, calm and patient in her black dress and white cap, her curls clustering around her face.
I'm sorry again, Sophie, she said. You were right about Gideon, and I was wrong. I should have listened to you. You're the last person on earth inclined to be foolish over men. The next time you say someone is worth trusting, I will believe you.
Sophie's smile flashed out, the smile that made even strangers forget her scar.
I understand why you said it.
I should have trusted you.
I shouldn't have got so angry, Sophie said. The truth is, I wasn't sure myself what he was going to do. I wasn't sure till he came back in the carriage with you all that he would side with us in the end.
It must be nice, though, Tessa said, playing with the bedclothes, that he's going to live here. He'll be so close to you.
It will be the worst thing in the world, Sophie said, and suddenly her eyes were full of tears.
Tessa froze in horror, wondering what she could have said so wrong. The tears stood in Sophie's eyes without falling, making their green shimmer.
If he lives here, he'll see me as I really am, a servant.
Her voice cracked.
I knew I should never have gone to see him when he asked me. Mrs. Brownwell's not the type to punish her servants for having followers and the like, but I knew it was wrong anyway, because he's himself and I'm me, and we don't belong together.
She reached up a hand and wiped at her eyes, and then the tears did fall, spilling down both her cheeks, the whole and the scarred one.
I could lose everything if I let myself. And what's he stand to lose? Nothing.
Gideon's not like that.
He's his father's son, Sophie said. Who says that doesn't matter? It's not as if he was going to marry a mundane as it was, but to see me building up his fire, doing the washing up. If he loves you, he won't mind all that. People always mind all that. They're not so noble as you think.
Tessa thought of Will, with his face in his hands, saying, If you love him, please, Tessa, don't tell him what I just told you. One finds nobility in the oddest places, Soph. Besides, would you really want to be a shadow hunter? Wouldn't you rather...
Oh, but I do want it, said Sophie. More than anything in the world, I always have.
I never knew, Tessa said, marveling.
I used to think if I married Master Jem...
Sophie picked at the blanket, then looked up and smiled bleakly.
You haven't broken his heart yet, have you?
No,
Tessa said. Just torn my own in two. I haven't broken his heart at all.